My name is Annie Ruth Powell, and I'm from Brooklyn, New York. I'm a doctoral student at Union Theological Seminary, working on my PhD in systematic theology. My special focus is womanist theology. This week we've been looking at, listening to women's voices, the most contemporary voices in liberation theology. On Tuesday, we dealt with feminist theology, Wednesday on womanist theology, Thursday, Mujeristas, Hispanic women's theology, and today we are doing Asian women's theology. The subject of the article we're using, or the title of the article we're using, is On Mirrors, Myths, and Murmurs. And it was written by Rita Nakashima Brock, who is an Asian American woman. As a matter of fact, she is Japanese and Puerto Rican. So she is one of the foremost writers of Asian American women's theology. They have a name now that they call Autumn, but I'm not sure how it's spelled or exactly what it stands for at this point. So, when you start to hear about it, you will know that it's Asian women's theology, and it's going to become more and more popular as time passes. I gave you these copies of On Mirrors, Myths, and Murmurs because right off, what I would like you to do is to read this article, read this first page. It, no matter how strange it seems to you or how difficult the pronunciation of the words are, just read it, and when you finish reading it, tell me what you felt, just what you felt as you are dealing with this story out of Asian culture. So we're going to just pause to do that right now. Everyone finished? Okay, let's talk about feeling stuff. Women can do that a lot better than men can.
Well, it makes me mad that brother and sister, you know, that the brother won't treat his sister well.
Right.
This whole sibling stuff.
Right.
Even among the gods, where I would like it to be different. Oh, well.
My first impression was that the sun goddess, the female, the goddess, was the one who was not the lesser god, that the brother was the lesser god. And I was pleased, I guess, or surprised.
Anything else? Just feeling stuff. It doesn't have to be an analysis of the article, just what you felt while you were reading the article.
I also felt sad that it was trickery that got her out of there. I mean, the trickery of hanging the mirror and keeping her from going. She didn't have a choice at that point about going back and leaving these people in their darkness.
Good.
She was tricked out.
Well, mine was rather, it was also disgust at how nasty he did it.
Mm-hmm.
It was just so deliberate.
Disgust?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Do we know who their mother is? Banned from the land of the dead. Who's the mother of both of them?
It doesn't say.
I was thinking in terms of the fact of it being Asian, that I felt I understood and identified with the sun goddess's silent, angry retreat.
Okay.
I do that. My anger is expressed in silent retreat. But yet while I read it, I kind of wished that she wouldn't have retreated. I didn't see that, even while I do that myself, I didn't necessarily see that as positive here. It was like I would have been behind her saying, you know, come on out and lash him on instead of a silent retreat. And the other one is that my experience is of mirror as a negative image.
Okay.
And here, mirror is a good image in this story. And in my upbringing, mirror is vanity and the bad image. Whereas here, it's good. And so that made me focus on it and try to I would have to really think to understand this.
Yeah, to have it end right at that sentence, a good mirror tells us the truth about.
And that really is different from my upbringing.
Just to explain to the last two who came in, we were reading the first portion of Rita Nakashima Brock's article on mirrors, mists, and murmurs toward an Asian American theology, and asking the group to respond to what you felt, whether it's an analysis of the article or your struggle to understand what's going on in the article. Okay, so far we have anger, silent retreat, the power of the goddess, trickery, disgust, and the mirror as a negative or vanity way of looking at it in the past, but seeing it presented here as a positive. Any other feelings that emerged for you?
Some curiosity.
Curiosity? Mm-hmm. Okay, tell me a little bit more about that.
I'd like to know more of the background of, like you said, who is the mother, but I was also interested, I had to stop and read the goddess that was preparing for the part that, you know, created the celebration and the party. I'd like to know what her function is, and I'm interested in how preparing for a shamanistic spirit generates a raucous body celebration. Sounds interesting.
Okay, so let me push that one a little bit and ask, is your curiosity born of your unfamiliarity with Asian culture?
Well, some, but it also seems, you know, a lot of different cultures have their gods and goddesses. You know, the Romans and the Greeks, and they all did their things for different stuff. I mean, I haven't read that any of that since I was a child. I read a lot of it when I was a child and enjoyed the fantasy and the adventures. And so that's part of it is to want to know more about the Asian culture, but part of it is to see how it is compared to other myths and legends.
Okay. All right. Did anyone else have something to add?
One thing I particularly liked, and I know it's because I grew up on the prairie, but I like very much that this culture identifies the gods with the land and with the seasons, and that they have an effect, and that you pay attention to that as human beings. And I think in the culture we live in now, we are pavement people, and we are not aware of this indebtedness of the seasons and the change and the good and the bad of them to the gods.
Very good.
So I liked that very much.
Did you have something to add? Have you finished reading it? I know it's been talking back and forth, kind of distracting you. But
it has been distracting, so I haven't been able to read.
But we have a good place to start, and just seeing all of the things that can jump out at you just from reading this part of the story that she's trying to tell. And this is a story that comes out of her culture, so she feels very comfortable about it, comfortable with it, and then we are able to see words or objects that we have previously understood as negative or vanity, and just see them being used in a different way, in a positive way, which helps us to hear someone else's perspective rather than just hanging on to a perspective that we've had all along and just really being very narrow in the way we think about things. So are there any other things that emerge, anything emerge for you, Verlon?
No, not more than what's already up
there. One of the things that came up for me when I was first trying to read it was the fact that I knew too little about Asian culture. And I found myself struggling to understand, trying to say the words, you know, and knew that I wasn't saying it correctly. And also had a little bit of knowledge of shamanism, but not Shinto at all. And so here she starts talking about this, and I remember the first time I tried to read it, wondering if Shinto was a place or a religion, you know, because that was not altogether clear just the way that it was, the word itself is written in another place farther down, like in that the last paragraph where she says the mirror is one of the most sacred symbols in Shinto. So I was saying, gee, where is Shinto? But then when I went back and reread it, then I said, Shinto is a religion. That thing she, when she starts talking about the spirits in the very first line, she says that. But my struggle with the other words, you know, made me almost forget what was said in the first line, and I had to go back and do it again and again and again. And what was significant about that for me was that it helped me to understand how Asian women and men have to struggle with our language, especially when they're in school. I have several Asian classmates who tell me, you know, when they're writing their exams, they have to sit down with the book they're reading in one hand, a dictionary on the other side, and they just really struggle with trying to understand exactly what's being said, and then they struggle with how to use the English language in a way that communicates the meaning they're trying to convey. And not only Asians, but also Africans and Latin Americans and so forth. So it just helped me to understand better part of their struggle. And it felt strange for me to have to struggle with just reading a simple story. It just felt strange. So that was helpful to me to be more sensitive to what they're going through. And then as we continue, we will see other things that will come up for us too, that will help us to understand Asian American women and men's plight even better than we do from this article. But stories are important to Asian Americans and to Hispanic Americans and to African Americans. Stories seem to be very, very important in women's liberation theology. And I think, well, first of all, let me just back up and say something about how the movement began and some of the obstacles Asian women face. This word we need to look at, I thought it was misspelled the first time I saw it. I thought either it was misspelled or that it was a typo. And as I continued to read and study Asian women's work, then I learned that this was her way of identifying it as theology being done from a woman's perspective, an Asian woman's perspective. And so she talks about, Brock that is, talks about Asian American women who are trained in seminaries and how they have lived their seminary experiences alone, struggling in silence and privately because there was just no one there for them to talk to. And sometimes, she says, for example, in the midst of marginalization, loneliness, and fragmentation, we have been struggling to live our theological concerns for justice, whole-making relationships, suffering, healing, and peace, and to integrate conflicting and often fragmented worlds of experience. Our theological work is inaccessible to our sisters who need it and unavailable for educating others. The noise of various established theologies has been unable to lure us into visibility and speech. And one of the things that she also talks about is how when, as ministers in various congregations, they are often the only Asian woman or Asian person in that congregation and how isolating that experience is. I don't know how many of you have been in situations where you find yourself the only one of the group. But it feels pretty strange sometimes. You try to grow into it, but it really feels pretty strange sometimes. The only woman in an all-male group, the only African-American in an all-white group, the only Christian in a mixed group of religious people, and things like that. It just feels kind of strange. I mean, if you had somebody else to turn to every once in a while and say, you know what I mean when you make your, when you, you know, you state your view about something, you would feel just a little bit better, but there's no one else there for you to even test your experience against. So it's just a real isolating experience that you have to just learn to cope with after, and you do learn to cope as it happens again and again. And then the other thing, of course, is that you always have to be the expert. People perceive you as speaking for everybody in your race or in your religion or whatever. And you know that you are not. You know that people in your own family would disagree with what you say and forget about the rest of the world. Your own family members don't necessarily hold the same views as you do about many things. So. You get cornered into that and trying to explain. You have to always preface every statement, well, speaking for myself or something similar to let people know that you don't set yourself up as an authority and that you're not speaking for your whole community. So anyway, the Asian women began meeting in 1978. There were 40 of them. And as they sat down to talk about their various experiences, they were amazed at what came forth. I mean, they couldn't believe that they were speaking to each other in this way because the silence had been such a dominant factor in their culture. And so to break that silence was really very powerful for them. And that's what we find in many situations, is that the things that hurt us the most are the things that we keep silent about. And that's why it just keeps hurting and hurting. You keep pushing it down, it keeps trying to come up. It wants to be said, but you won't say it, and it can't say itself, so. It's just a vicious cycle. And so I went to the American Academy of Religion last year and heard an Asian women's group speak. And they were talking about how that silence operated in their culture, that women just were not supposed to be very vocal. But the women in America have found ways to get around that. And so the young lady who was reporting was saying that she did a study on Asian American women in congregations within, you know, a certain area. I don't remember the state, but the outcome of that was in asking about this silence. And the outcome was that the women were silent for various reasons. They had their little thing going among themselves that, you know, discussion groups, for example, to talk about the ways in which they were oppressed. And when they were in a group where the males were talking, they would have eye contact with one another, you know, as if to say, yeah, that's what they say, but we know better. You know, they already had something in mind to help them to cope with whatever was being said or to counter whatever was being said. And at other times they are silent because it's just safe to keep quiet sometimes. You can't always speak up. Sometimes you have to think about what the consequences are going to be at that particular moment if you speak then rather than feeling more confident that this is the time to speak. And it also depends on where you are psychologically, especially if you know that your speaking is going to result in some kind of controversy or conflict. You have to decide whether you're ready to take that on right now or not. And I mean, I do it all the time because I don't have the energy for every fight. You know, some things just are not important enough to me for me to expend my energy fighting over this. I have something else that takes priority. If I get around to it, I'll come back to this later. But for now, I need to use my energy to do other things. And the other thing is how distracting those fights can be. Because when you undertake one, it may just get you so caught up in that struggle that the struggle that you should be focusing on in order to accomplish what you want to do gets left by the wayside. And so that's one of the things that came out, knowing when to speak, time to speak and a time to keep silent. And so another thing that Rita Nakashima Brock talks about is suffering. She wants us to look at the ways in which we suffer. She says, suffering in our theology is not the martyrdom of traditional Christian theology in which one more powerful or worthy than others take on their suffering paternalistically, or in which we masochistically endure suffering for the improvement of our soul and character. The self-denying faith of orthodox dependence on God. These interpretations of suffering have been rightly rejected by feminists. We must seek to embrace and acknowledge our own suffering and the suffering of all creation to bring healing to our broken world. This solidarity with the suffering world is not paternalistic rescue work. Our responsibility rests not in assuming others' suffering, but in acknowledging where we can change our own lives to cause less suffering and in offering what we can in solidarity with others for their own healing and liberation. We must learn to listen, to hold and support others for their empowerment and ours. And so when she talks about embracing suffering, she says that you first have to be in touch with your own pain. And before you can help yourself and before you can help anyone else. And so she talks about Jesus and the cross in this experience, I mean, in her theology, but in a different way. So I just put a little cross over here to try to get at what does the cross symbolize for you? Anybody?
Innocent suffering.
Suffering?
Innocent suffering.
Innocent suffering.
Yeah.
Okay.
It means innocent suffering.
Innocent suffering. Anything else? The cross, what does it symbolize for us? We are Christians here. What does the cross symbolize for us?
Well, actually, just simply death.
Death?
I think of it a little bit like the electric chair.
Like what?
Like the electric chair. It was the way of putting criminals to death at a certain time. And we think of it as innocent from our Christian point of view, mm-hmm. but if we had lived in that time, we might not have. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyone else? Brother?
I see connecting with our own, or facing our own death and pain and fear.
Facing death and fear?
Yeah, our own death and fear.
Anyone else?
Mine is completely the reverse. To the other side.
Oh, good. Come on with
when
it.
When I go to communion or just to church and have a silent moment to look up at the cross, I see God's gift of salvation to me. I see hope. I see forgiveness and renewal. You know, I'd have communion every day just to feel that. On a regular basis, it's like Sundays is not enough, or even, you know. So I don't see it. We have a really striking Good Friday service where they have a very plain cross, and they take it out. Somebody drags it out, and out before you can hear the nails going in, and that's then I hear the suffering and the death and the pain and sorrow. But just looking at it. Regularly, there's a regular old cross up there. It's a gift.
Okay.
It's something I give thanks for.
Anyone else?
I see purposeful acceptance.
Purposeful acceptance. Anyone else?
It also seems very human form to me. I mean, it's a human being standing upright with hands out. You know, if you're standing up in the world, it's the shape of us.
Human form?
Mm-hmm. Our skeletal frame.
That's good. All of those are good. This is what suffering, this is what the cross symbolizes for us. But for Asian women, they often express this embrace of suffering in the image of the cross, but not as a symbol of substitutionary death or self-sacrifice, but as the image of solidarity, of how God suffers with us, and of what it means to suffer with one another. That's how Asian women view the cross or use the cross as a symbol. And to understand this approach to suffering, we have to shift, she says, our perspective from Western Christian to Mahayana Buddhist. And this reveals the distinctive Asian American theological contribution in terms of the meaning of suffering. And so she, in constructing her theology, she used the work of a Buddhist named Joanna Macy, particularly a book called Despair and Personal Power in the Nuclear Age. And in this book, Macy speaks of feeling our own despair and fear as the key to loving, to hoping, and to acting. She says this ability runs against the dominant American preoccupation with success, in which pain is viewed as dysfunctional. And then she says that we lack the mirrors to tell the truth about our lives. And so the next question we want to ask is what are the implications of suffering? I mean, what happens in our own lives? What are the implications of suffering?
Well, when I am suffering and have a lot of internal pain, I usually try to ignore it until God won't let me ignore it anymore. It's his way of poking at me to say it's time to look and it's time to stop hiding from myself and time to make some changes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, because I know, I mean, other people I've talked to too, they only go to get counseling when they are in so much pain that they can hardly make it through a day.
Right.
And that's what drives us to make some changes.
Anyone else? What are the implications of suffering for you? Anybody brave enough to tell us?
I usually try to, sort of, I don't know if ignoring is the right word, but trying to sedate it. You know, I eat too much or drink too much or watch too much TV or read or somehow try to, you know, I don't try to make friends with it. Not right away, you know, I try to.
Not right away.
I always think of it in terms of physical pain, and I'm very aware that I don't really know what happened. I haven't had that experience myself of either a disease or an accident or something that causes a kind of pain that is unbearable. And I read of people for whom going through that brings you to some kind of strength or understanding that a person who doesn't go through it can't have.
Well, and what so, about emotional pain? We all have that on some level.
Yeah. I feel like the kinds of things I've experienced, time has a great deal to do with time passing, change. I just feel like I'm young enough and lucky enough so that I don't understand what I know a lot of people's experience is.
Right.
I'm not going around just wishing to have that experience.
For sure.
But I'm just aware that I don't know. Therefore, it's hard to make judgments where you think you should ought not come to conclusions about how people should respond through suffering or through pain, because you don't get to know that unless you get to go through it.
Well,
you can empathize,
yes,
but that's not the same as really understanding.
Well, what Brock says about this is that if we allow ourselves to suffer, it means risking feeling stupid, feeling guilty, unpatriotic, doubtful, powerless, panicky, too emotional, or a failure. We can be accused of provoking a disaster or causing others distress, but to deny our own suffering and the suffering of others leads us, according to Macy, this woman she was quoting in Despair and Power in the Nuclear Age, leads us to live an alienated double life haunted by self-doubt, to compulsive displacement activity, to passivity, to psychological projection of our pain, to destructive behaviors, to burnout, to intellectual apathy, and to the inability to receive painful information. We choose these options instead of our pain, often immobilized by the fear of moving through that pain. And I can really relate to what she's saying. And I thought about the African American literature that Paul Olson used in one of his workshops, so I brought it to say how Asian and other women use their stories of suffering or whatever their stories are to invite you to come in and enter in to their pain. But they're asking you, especially Asian women, to be in touch with your own pain first, no matter how minor that pain may appear to be to you. Just get in touch with it anyway. Often we don't want to hurt. We don't want to hurt. And I know that. I was raped when I was 17 years old. And I never even told my mother about it. But when I was about 42, it's like Alice said, I couldn't run, I couldn't hide from it anymore. I was working at the police department as a police administrative aide. The report came to my desk, a rape had occurred in my building to a 9-year-old girl, and all of my whole experience that I had been trying to press down by every time I hear rape mentioned on the radio, I turn it to another station, it was on TV, I switched the channel, the newspaper, don't read that article, read other articles, just to keep it down, you know. But I couldn't push it anymore. And not only was God telling me that I had to deal with my own experience of rape, the voice of God said to me that I had to forgive the rapist. And I said, oh no, you, this is not fair. It's not fair. And I argued back and forth with God about, you know, having to forgive the rapist. And so finally, I just broke down and I said, well, God, if you want me to forgive him, you must be going to show me how, because I don't know. All I could think about was just how I felt. My body just felt slimy. Every time I imagined him touching me. So to talk about forgiveness was just, you know, it was something that I felt was humanly impossible for me until I started fasting and praying and until God started showing me all the dirt that I had done, which in somebody else's interpretation would have been comparable to rape. We say there are different ways that rape can occur. And I raped a whole lot of folk, you know, in various ways. And so when God showed me that, then I couldn't run and hide from it anymore. I could not run and hide from it anymore. So the whole idea for Brock, at least, is to get us to get in touch with our own pain. I had to get in touch with that pain. And it took me years before I could get to the point where I could talk about it without actually reliving the experience every time I said something about it. And it was only, I think about 3 or 4 years ago, that I got brave enough to do some confronting. Not the rapist, because I didn't see him, didn't know where he was, and wasn't going to go out of my way to get in touch with him, not knowing his situation, you know, after so many years had passed. But a role that my uncle played in it, you know, and I had this hate, this love-hate relationship going on with him. I decided that I was gonna confront him, so I prayed and prayed and prayed and prayed and prayed, and finally was able to just confront him and at least hear him say that he didn't know that's what had happened to me, you know, and if he had had any idea that that's what was going to happen, he wouldn't have, he would have acted differently, you know. But not to get into to all of that, but I had to get in touch with that pain, and it was the hardest thing in the world for me to do. The hardest thing in the world for me to do. And even now, as things come up, it's as Verlon says, sometimes you just adopt other ways to deal with it for a while. Keep pushing it down until you have the energy to really address it appropriately. So anyway, in talking about Brock, she has some positive aspects that result from pain. Would anybody care to name some positive things that happened to you as a result?
I just wanted to go back to that list that you said, the response to pain, and it sounded like all of them were self-negating or blaming self, and I didn't hear resentment or blaming the other.
Let's see, she said alienated, double life, haunted by self-doubt, that's one. Compulsive displacement activity, passive, most of them are personal. If you don't deal with personal pain.
But what I'm saying is that before that, even the words sounded like the person was mainly blaming themselves.
Yeah.
Rather than blaming the other person. And in a painful situation, we usually do one or the other, or some of both. But, I didn't hear the resentment and the hatred and the blame of others. In the list, that's what I was
No, thinking. No, she doesn't include that. She recognizes that some of our pain is not self-inflicted, but whether it is or not, she's saying that we have to deal with our personal hurts and then reach out to others. That's why I say I have to enter into another person's pain. And Richard Wright's poem, Between the World and Me, I don't know how many of you are familiar with it, but anyway, it's the story of, it's a poem about a black man who was lynched, and Wright came upon his remains. And so when, as he was looking at the remains, it wasn't another black brother. Suddenly it became him. And he could imagine all of the things that he saw around to indicate that there was some kind of lynching party. He could imagine in his mind that he was the one with the noose around his neck, and the persons who were in this party were standing around drinking gin, you know, and telling jokes and smoking cigarettes. He even found a whore's lipstick, you know, somebody who had time to be so casual about the whole thing that you can put on lipstick and perhaps think about who you might attract out here since you are in business. And so many times I had a friend who was very ill, and she used to tell me about her pain, and God knows that was the most painful thing. I'd start doing like this. I wouldn't be in front of her though. I'd be at home on the telephone in my living room. It was even harder when I was with her and she was telling me about it because I was hurting. I had entered into her painful situation and was hurting with her. And so that's what Brock says God does with us, is suffer with us. And so that kind of struggling, that kind of suffering is a suffering that enables others to be in solidarity with you because they have allowed themselves to feel their own pain and to enter into you, and by feeling their own pain, they are better able to enter into your pain. And she says the positive results of that is the, at least one, is the interconnectedness with life and all other beings. It is the living web out of which our individual separate existences have risen and in which we are all interwoven. Our lives extend beyond our skins in radical interdependence with the rest of the world. And I mean, that's something similar to what I heard Al Pitcher saying earlier in the week when he talked about creation. So when it comes to sources, the Asian women have gone back into their own culture and taken their myths, their stories, and are using them to construct their theologies. But they also use other religious sources. They talk about the religious pluralism in Asia, and how there's only a small percentage of Christians there. And besides that, before the ones who are there now became Christians, they were either Buddhists or Hindus or whatever. So they don't want to just to devalue everything in those other religions. They look for liberating themes out of the other religious traditions that they can appropriate into their own ways of doing theology. So but they don't use them uncritically. They realize that those religions were male dominated as well. And so they have to be very critical and suspect, you know, when they begin. But when they do find liberating things, they adopt them. And it has been helpful to them in helping them to maintain some kind of connection with their cultural roots. See, that's the whole thing about the groups that we've been talking about the past 2 days, especially the Hispanics and the Asian women, is that it's hard being biracial. You don't want to cut off your identity to your roots. You want to claim both of your races, because that's who you are. And so to do otherwise is almost a denial of who you are. So we talked about the importance of pain. How much time do we have? I got the watch, don't I? Mm-hmm. Oh, good. 15 minutes. What time are we supposed to start?
I started at 11:40.
Okay, 10 minutes. So, I guess one of the things that we can do is to just to talk about these words, the relationship between these key words in Brock's article, which are mirror, suffering, silence, and healing. So we can start anywhere you want to, but since we've already had a list on the board, if somebody wants to talk about mirror a little bit more, what that means to you, the imaging, your self-reflection, seeing yourself. Is that a hand?
No.
Oh, no. What is it like when you really see yourself, or have we taking time to look at ourselves?
It's really hard even with a mirror, because you look at yourself and you see yourself straight on, but very seldom does anyone else ever see you that way. I mean, you know, the reality of yourself is so much more than just that, that one dimension looking at oneself.
Well, that's right. That's those things that don't come forth in the mirror, don't come across in the mirror. That's what she's talking about.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Those are the things that are being mirrored that she's talking about, the things that you don't see in the reflection, but you know are underneath because they are in your mind's eye.
In another session a few weeks ago, David was in, and they had us imaging something, and he ended up writing a poem that just came about mirrors, and it started out, I can't remember it all, but it started saying, we hang our mirrors in all the wrong places, and, you know, one beside the door as you go out, so you kind of fix yourself as you go away, and then there were a couple of others, and it was, you know, the car with the rear view mirror, where you're seeing things distorted and smaller than they really are, but yet it's essential. And it was a kind of fascinating thing about how we look in the mirrors incorrectly or in the wrong places.
Berlin?
I have a friend who told me this experience, but I've experienced it myself. But she was saying she was walking downtown somewhere, and just out of the corner of her eye, got a glimpse of herself in a storefront window. And she was just shocked, because she said it was all wrong. It wasn't how she wanted to appear, mm-hmm. and it's not what she saw when she looked in the mirror. And I felt that myself. I mean, you are in some mall or down wherever, and you catch yourself, I catch myself in a mirror just walking, and it's like, ooh, you know, is that me? Is that how I'm coming across? Mm-hmm. And it's like, for a split second, you know, you see yourself unable to fool yourself or hide yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
As a matter of fact, and it's just a shock.
Yeah, that's true. Anyone else want to talk about mirrors?
I guess mirrors need to reflect different levels for me. I see my body image and I have some impressions of that. And then I need a mirror that helps me look at my motives and what I'm about.
Yes.
And then I need another mirror to help me see deep down that I am a child of God and that there is a place of unity and peace and wholeness within me.
Amen.
One other interesting thing about mirrors is the ability to catch light and start fires. You know, you glass or a mirror, but one of the interesting things about a lighthouse off the coast of Egypt is that a whole fleet of ships was destroyed by people slanting the sun toward these wooden ships mm-hmm. that were coming, and you know, fires started, and there's a potential for use in some other capacity other than looking at yourself. That's pretty amazing. It has a lot of power.
That's true. What about suffering?
I see broken mirrors.
Okay, that's good. That's great. Suffering is broken mirrors, okay? Broken lives.
Mm-hmm. Pieces of things.
Anyone else?
Well, suffering is the cave. I mean, she suffers in the cave, and there's no, it's very solitary. All the gods are on the outside waiting for her to come out, tricking her with the mirror to come out. It's very solitary. It's dark. There is no light in
there.
That's
right.
The suffering associated with the cave is very stifling. And she can't see herself.
Anyone else?
I guess what I'm hearing in that is that it's possible to get stuck in the suffering. That if we make the suffering the reality, that we can get absorbed in the suffering and we don't see beyond the suffering to
yes.
the potentiality, the meaning and possibility in it.
I think in this case, the silence goes with the suffering when we're talking about this particular hero and heroine in the story. She's alone, she's isolated, so she's obviously cut off from everybody else and not in communication with anybody else, which is another form of suffering, in my opinion. And one of the reasons I say that has to do with working with people with serious illnesses. You know, it's like she said, you get some folk when they're not in touch with their own pain, they never want to hurt, they want you to always be happy and jolly and pretend that everything is okay with you and with the world. And you can't tell them about your pain. They don't allow you to give voice to that pain. And many of the people who have terminal illnesses will say that they cannot talk to their family members. Women with cancer can't talk to their daughters. And they can't talk to oftentimes their husbands and other family members because they are just unable to hear about these painful experiences. And so what you do by not talking to them or listening to them when they want to express the hurt and pain that's in their lives, and this goes for anything, is silence them. So that's a form of oppression, where you have just, you've just took away their voice, where they can't tell you anything about what's going on with them. And as a result of the silence, you suffer as well, because you are not able to say anything about the fears that you feel, or the little pain that does surface that prevents you from wanting to feel it any more deeply, simply because this is a loved one. I was in a workshop recently where the question was, who suffers the most, the sufferer or the person who loves the one who is suffering? And it's difficult to say, because sometimes it really seems like the family members are suffering as greatly as the person who is ill. And the person who is ill is released from his or her suffering through death. And we suffer the grief and loss of a loved one for years and years to come. You know, and I just wonder if Asian women have not stumbled upon something very, very important about this pain and suffering, and how we can use the pain in our own lives, not only to transform ourselves, but also to enable, to empower others. Are there any additional comments that any of you would like to add?
I just think when I'm going through suffering, there's, you know, people say, well, I find it hard to think about what's on the other side. Sometimes, you know, I'm in it so deep, I don't even know if I'll get to the other side. So it's hard to be optimistic the way people want you to be optimistic and say, well, this too shall pass. It's because when you're in the thick of it, you're not really sure. If it will pass.
As a counselor, there are kind of three dimensions. One is that I can share my suffering with another person. Secondly, I can be with another person where they are suffering and dare to stand with them and be with them. And the third is that I can feel the pain inside of me. I'm concerned about taking on too much of the pain inside of me. I'm not sure that serves that much of a purpose, because I can end up with it. For instance, if I do a whole day's counseling, I can end up with a tremendous burden of pain, and that I don't think is going to serve them or me. And so I like the image of being with them in their pain, or standing with them and certainly sensing their pain, but not needing to take it on myself.
Right, right. That's very important, and especially in counseling. What I had to learn how to do was, I found myself taking it on all the time. Oh, was I taking it on? But what I had to learn how to do was to release it. Let it enter me enough for me to feel it and know how the person hurts as much as I could know. And if there's something I can do about it, do that, but then release it.
Yeah.
And I did do that through my prayer and my meditation, you know, just to let it go.
I was going to make a comment that sort of connects these things. I think maybe it's American to think that about everything we should try to do something. You know, that if someone tells you their pain, one of the reasons it's uncomfortable for you is that you assume right away you should be the one to try to do something about it. And lots of times you can't, but you back away from just being present.
Right.
From just listening.
Yes.
And just, and I have a hunch that's particularly American, because we're always thinking we have to be pulling ourselves up by our bootstraps and being there for somebody. And for counselors, it must be particularly hard, because, you know, you're there in a capacity to try to do something. And yet the reality may be that the tangible thing that you can do isn't real obvious.
Yes.
Well, my wife, Gary, was very helpful when she said, would you let me have my cry?
Yeah.
Because I'd see her cry, and I'd start trying to do everything in the world to get her out of it. And finally she said, stop it.
Yeah. Sometimes, I mean, you want to stop the pain, but the person needs to work through the pain.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they can enter some form of healing, or at least a place where they can feel comfortable that it's all right. It's all right. I'm sick, but God is with me. I'm dying, but I'm a child of God. I have something better to look forward to. So if you got to let people get to that point. I wanted to heal everybody. I wanted to get to the healing before we went through the suffering and pain. You know, just let's get on with the healing. Don't do nothing but pray for healing, you know. But it didn't work.